Chapter 5. Villagers' Pattens and Clocks. They came to a grizzled church, whose massive square tower rose unbroken into the darkening sky, the lower parts being illuminated by the nearest lamp sufficiently to show how completely the mortar from the joints of the stonework had been nibbled out by time and weather, which had planted in the crevices thus made little tufts of stone crop and grass almost as far up as the very battlements. From this tower the clock struck 8, and thereupon a bell began to toll with a peremptory clang. The curfew was still rung in Casterbridge, and it was utilized by the inhabitants as a signal for shutting their shops. No sooner did the deep notes of the bell throb between the house fronts than a clatter of shutters arose through the whole length of the high street. In a few minutes business at Casterbridge was ended for the day. Other clocks struck 8 from time to time, one gloomily from the gallery, another from the gable of an almshouse, with a preparative creak of machinery, more audible than the note of the bell. A row of tall, varnished case clocks from the interior of a clockmaker's shop joined in one after another just as the shutters were enclosing them, like a row of actors delivering their final speeches before the fall of the curtain. Then chimes were heard stammering out the Sicilian Mariner's hymn, so that chronologists of the advanced school were appreciably on their way to the next hour before the whole business of the old one was satisfactorily wound up. In an open space before the church walked a woman with her gown sleeves rolled up so high that the edge of her underlinen was visible, and her skirt tucked up through her pocket hole. She carried a load under her arm from which she was pulling pieces of bread, and handing them to some other women who walked with her, which pieces they nibbled critically. The sight reminded Mrs. Henchard Newson and her daughter that they had an appetite, and they inquired of the woman for the nearest baker's. "Ye may as well look for manna food as good bread in Casterbridge just now," she said, after directing them. "They can blare their trumpets and thump their drums, and have their roaring dinners," waving her hand towards a point further along the street, where the brass band could be seen standing in front of an illuminated building, "but we must needs be put to for want of a wholesome crust. There's less good bread than good beer in Casterbridge now." "And less good beer than Swipes," said a man with his hands in his pockets. "How does it happen there's no good bread?" asked Mrs. Henchard. "Oh, 'tis the corn factor, he's the man that our millers and bakers all deal why, and he has sold them growed wheat, which they didn't know was growed, so they say, till the dough ran all over the ovens like quicksilver, so that the loaves be as fired as toads, and like suet pudding inside. I've been a wife, and I've been a mother, and I never see such unprincipled bread in Casterbridge as this before. But you must be a real stranger here not to know what's made all the poor folks inside splim like load bladders this week." "I am," said Elizabeth's mother shyly, not wishing to be observed further till she knew more of her future in this place. She withdrew with her daughter from the speaker's side. Getting a couple of biscuits at the shop indicated as a temporary substitute for a meal, they next bent their steps instinctively to where the music was playing. 5. A few score yards brought them to the spot where the town be, and was now shaking the window panes with the strains of the roast beef of old England. The building before whose doors they had pitched their music stands was the chief hotel in Casterbridge, namely, the King's Arms. A spacious bow window projected into the street over the main portico, and from the open sashes came the babble of voices, the jingle of glasses, and the drawing of corks. The blinds, moreover, being left unclosed, the whole interior of this room could be surveyed from the top of a flight of stone steps to the road wagon office opposite, for which reason a knot of idlers had gathered there. "We might, perhaps, after all, make a few inquiries about our relation, Mr. Henchard," whispered Mrs. Newson, who, since her entry into Casterbridge, had seemed strangely weak and agitated. "And this, I think, would be a good place for trying it, just to ask, you know, how he stands in the town, if he is here, as I think he must be. You, Elizabeth Jane, had better be the one to do it. I'm too worn out to do anything. Pull down here, fall first. She sat down upon the lowest step, and Elizabeth Jane obeyed her directions and stood among the idlers. What's going on tonight? Asked the girl, after singling out an old man and standing by him long enough to acquire a neighborly right of converse. Well, ye must be a stranger, sure, said the old man, without taking his eyes from the window. Hi, 'tis a great public dinner of the gentle people, and such like leading vote why the mayor in the chair. As we plainer fellows bain't invited, they leave the winder shutters open, that we may get just a sense out here. If you mount the steps you can see em. That's Mr. Henchard, the mayor, at the end of the table, a facing ye, and that's the councilmen right and left. Ah, lots of them when they begun life were no more than I be now. Henchard, said Elizabeth Jane, surprised, but by no means suspecting the whole force of the revelation. She ascended to the top of the steps. Her mother, though her head was bowed, had already caught from the in-window tones that strangely riveted her attention, before the old man's words, Mr. Henchard, the mayor, reached her ears. She arose, and stepped up to her daughter's side, as soon as she could do so without showing exceptional eagerness. The interior of the hotel dining room was spread out before her, with its tables, and glass, and plate, and inmates. Facing the window, in the chair of dignity, sat a man about 40 years of age, of heavy frame, large features, and commanding voice, his general build being rather coarse than compact. He had a rich complexion, which verged on swarthiness, a flashing black eye, and dark, bushy brows and hair. When he indulged in an occasional loud laugh at some remark among the guests, his large mouth parted, so far back, as to show to the rays of the chandelier a full score more of the 32 sound white teeth, that he obviously still could boast of. That laugh was not encouraging to strangers, and hence it may have been well that it was rarely heard. Many theories might have been built upon it. It fell in well with conjectures of a temperament which would have no pity for weakness, but would be ready to yield ungrudging admiration to greatness and strength. Its producer's personal goodness, if he had any, would be of a very fitful cast and occasional almost oppressive generosity, rather than a mild and constant kindness. Susan Henchard's husband-in-law, at least, sat before them, matured in shape, stiffened in line, exaggerated in traits, disciplined, thought-marked in a word, older. Elizabeth, encumbered with no recollections as her mother was, regarded him with nothing more than the keen curiosity and interest which the discovery of such unexpected social standing in the long-sought relative naturally begot. He was dressed in an old-fashioned evening suit, an expanse of frilled shirt showing on his broad breast, jeweled studs, and a heavy gold chain. Three glasses stood at his right hand, but, to his wife's surprise, the two for wine were empty, while the third, a tumbler, was half full of water. When last as he had seen him, he was sitting in a corduroy jacket, fustian waistcoat and breeches, and tanned leather leggings, with a basin of hot furmity before him. Time, the magician, had wrought much here. Watching him, and thus thinking of past days, she became so moved, that she shrank back against the jamb of the wagon office doorway to which the steps gave access, the shadow from it conveniently hiding her features. She forgot her daughter till a touch from Elizabeth Jane aroused her. Have you seen him, mother? Whispered the girl. Yes, yes, answered her companion hastily. Have seen him, and it is enough for me. Now I only want to go pass away die. Why oh what? She drew closer, and whispered in her mother's ear, does he seem to you not likely to befriend us? I thought he looked a generous man. What a gentleman he is, isn't he? And how his diamond studs shine. How strange that you should have said he might be in the stocks, or in the workhouse, or dead. Did ever anything go more by contraries? Why do you feel so afraid of him? I am not at all. I'll call upon him. He can but say he don't own such remote kin. I don't know at all. I can't tell what to say about. I feel so down. Don't be that, Mother. Now we have got here and all. Rest there where you be a little while. I will look on and find out more about him. I don't think I can ever meet Mr. Henchard. He is not how I thought he would be. He overpowers me. I don't wish to see him any more. But wait a little time and consider. Elizabeth Jane had never been so much interested in anything in her life as in their present position, partly from the natural elation she felt at discovering herself akin to a coach, and she gazed again at the scene. The younger guests were talking and eating with animation. Their elders were searching for titbits, and sniffing and grunting over their plates like sows nuzzling for acorns. Three drinks seemed to be sacred to the company: port, sherry, and rum, outside which old established trinity few or no palates ranged. A row of ancient drummers with crowned figures on their sides, and each primed with a spoon, was now placed down the table, and these were promptly filled with grog at such high temperatures as to raise serious considerations for the articles exposed to its vapors. But Elizabeth Jane noticed that, though this filling went on with great promptness up and down the table, nobody filled the mayor's glass, who still drank large quantities of water from the tumbler behind the clump of crystal vessels intended for wine and spirits. "They don't fill Mr. Henchard's wine glasses," she ventured to say to her elbow acquaintance, the old man. "Ah, no. Don't he know him to be the celebrated abstaining worthy of that name? He scorns all tempting liquors, never touches nothing. Oh yes, he've strong qualities that way. I have heard tell that he swear a gospel oath in bygone times, and has bowed by it ever since. So they don't press him, knowing it would be unbecoming in the face of that. For yer gospel oath is a serious thing." Another elderly man, hearing this discourse, now joined in by inquiring, "How much longer have he got to suffer from it, Solomon Longways?" "Another 2 year, they say. I don't know the why and the wherefore of his fixing such a time, for never has told anybody. But 'tis exactly 2 calendar years longer, they say. A powerful mind to hold out so long." "True. But there's great strength in hope. Knowing that in 24 months' time he'll be out of your bondage, and able to make up for all you've suffered, by partaking without stint, why, it keeps a man up, no doubt. No doubt, Christopher Coney, no doubt. And a must need such reflections, a lonely widow man," said Longways. "When did he lose his wife?" asked Elizabeth. "I never knowed her. 'Twas afore he came to Casterbridge," Solomon Longways replied with terminative emphasis, as if the fact of his ignorance of Mrs. Henchard were sufficient to deprive her history of all interest. "But I know that he's a banded teetotaler, and that if any of his men be ever so little overtook by a drop, he's down upon them as stern as the Lord upon the jovial Jews." "Has he many men, then?" said Elizabeth Jane. "Many. Why, my good maid, he's the powerfulest member of the town council, and quite a principal man in the country round besides. Never a big dealing in wheat, barley, oats, hay, roots, and such like, but Henchard's got a hand in it. Eh, and he'll go into other things too, and that's where he makes his mistake. He worked his way up from nothing when he came here, and now he's a pillar of the town. Not but what he's been shaken a little to hear about this bad corn he has supplied in his contracts. I've seen the sun rise over Durnover Moor these 69 year, and though Mr. Henchard has never cussed me unfairly ever since I've worked for'n, seeing I be but a little small man, I must say that I have never before tasted such rough bread as has been made from Henchard's wheat lately. 'Tis that growed out, that the economists call it malt, and there's a list at bottom o' the loaf as thick as the sole of one's shoe." The band now struck up another melody, and by the time it was ended the dinner was over, and speeches began to be made. The evening being calm, and the windows still open, these orations could be distinctly heard. Henchard's voice arose above the rest. He was telling a story of his hay-dealing experiences, in which he had outwitted a sharper who had been bent upon outwitting him. "Ha ha ha! responded his audience at the upshot of the story, and hilarity was general till a new voice arose with, "This is all very well, but how about the bad bread?" It came from the lower end of the table, where there sat a group of minor tradesmen who, although part of the company, appeared to be a little below the social level of the others, and who seemed to nourish a certain independence of Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.